Accession number 27347, reel 25.
Stanley Brand, reel 25.
Having arrived in Canada, there was no relaxation at all. We had so many things that had to be done. I've explained why we had to swing our compasses, first of all. That was the most important thing in our mind, because we were so dependent upon steering compass courses and doing dead reckoning from that. Having done the swinging of compasses, we liaised. I spent a lot of time with the engineer officer talking about things that we'd had on the crossing, that we'd had quite a lot of magneto drops and so on due to salt water, and then go and see the electrician officer and tell him about the problems we'd had with our ASV and with the radio and so on. Again, salt water. Was there anything we could do to improve the conditions? Of course, one of the very important things was to get our parachutes all along to the parachute section and get them hung to make sure that there's no mildew going to appear through dampness and confined space in the pack. To get them hung in a an air-conditioned building was terribly important. And then, having hung them, we had to go along and pack them ourselves. This was an Admiralty instruction to pack our own parachutes. We said that it was because they wanted to make sure that we brought the aeroplane back, that we never jumped out of it. I would have always preferred to trust my life to the hands of a well-trained wren who knew how to pack a parachute than myself, who'd watched somebody do it. And then to do it myself and jump out of an aeroplane with my life entangled with it, no, it wasn't on. But we had to do it, and it was a humbling experience.
Is there a technique that you can remember for how you pack the parachute?
No, I can't. The main thing was to have a long bench covered with Admiralty linoleum, which had no snags on it, because if you laddered a silk parachute, you could get a run that could tear the parachute apart. No, the important thing was to have the equipment, the table to do it. And the know-how, I suppose it could have been acquired, but we would never have wanted to rely upon our own know-how for it. So we were kept pretty busy. I had to go along to the stores officer and make sure that there were no shortages that he knew of on the list that I'd submitted the minute I came ashore. I'd indent for this, that and the other. Very often I'd be cut by half. But generally, the stores over there were very, very good. They knew the conditions that we were going to be operating under, and they did everything they could, even down to pinching things out of an aircraft and making it unserviceable, as long as we got the bits that we needed. We were very grateful to him for that. Mind, I suppose he got many a free drink from us in the wardroom afterwards. We also had to contact the local equivalent of the Women's Voluntary Service, because they supplied the comforts for the troops. I used to get balaclavas and fingerless gloves and sweaters and socks and mufflers and all the other things that we needed, which we couldn't have managed without. We needed them, and these good ladies provided them. They provided writing paper, packs of cards. They were generosity itself. Can't speak too highly of those ladies over there. The crowning thing was just before we departed on one trip, I was called to the gangway. There was a big white van there, and two ladies and about four men, who said, "Where do we put it?" And I said, "Where do we put what?" And they said, "This billiard table that we're bringing you." I said, "I've no room for a billiard table." "Oh, but I'm sure you'd enjoy having it." I said, "What, on a ship that's going up and down and rolling from side to side?" I know it seems very ungenerous of me to turn it down, but it is difficult. They said, "Well, the people who've given it will be so disappointed." So eventually I took it aboard. It was a half-size table, it wasn't a full-size table. We suggested having a gamble, having a gamble on take the triangle away, and how long would it be before all the balls were in pockets without us touching them. So, yes, with the highest score, of course. No, it ended up on its side. It wasn't in use, but I should have loved to been able to write in my logbook that today I've become the billiards champion of the Fleet Air Arm North Atlantic area. The other things we had to do, of course, was we had to do shopping for our loved ones back home, the girls that we hoped would be loved ones. Nylons were just coming in at that time, and back home the demand for nylons was, well, it was so great you could never satisfy it. We always had limited cash, though, because we hadn't a system for paying ourselves or our non-commissioned people. We had to draw money on account whenever we came up to a naval establishment, and then we had to account for it. After my first trip, I found that it was politic to draw as much as possible over the other side and never anything over this side, because accounts got lost or misplaced and never caught up with us. So if I could get a cash payment for the troops and it never caught up, I was full marks with the troops. They'd do anything for me. The other thing, we wanted to shop over there for things like a ham on the bone. What a treat that was in wartime. I remember after delivering the first ham on the bone to my folks back in Middlesbrough, I was offered ham and lentil soup, and that was all that mother had left. She'd given the rest away. But I used to get tins of ham, tins of Spam, which were a treat in those days. But our time for shopping ashore was very limited. We did have some time at Admiralty House in Halifax, where we were members as of right. But we used to lead them a hell of a dance, I'm afraid, because if two flights who'd never met before happened to be in Halifax at the same time and gravitated to Admiralty House, there was always a bit of competitiveness in laying on entertainment for each other. One of the favourites was to take the big red carpet out of reception and lay it down in the wardroom itself as a flight deck, and do dummy deck landings with a batsman there, and us racing round and round and being batted in and then collapsing in a heap on the flight deck. And another one I remember very vividly was one of our competitive flights decided to put on a show of what it was like in a submarine, in a U-boat, and you'd get the typical U-boat commander there who'd give his salutes as he took over from his junior, and he'd look through the periscope with his head with his cap flatter back. And after a due sinking of ships by Achtung, torpedo loose, and noises off, he'd shout, "Achtung, string bag," where panic would ensue, and all the people who were supposed to be U-boat people would hair over to one corner of the wardroom, which had a three-piece suite across the corner, which was usually occupied by top brass hats, gold braid. And behind it, in the corner, were a couple of pipes that went up from floor to ceiling. And our opposing flight had decided that that would be up to the hatch to get out of the submarine. So they trampled all over the brass hats, about 15 people, trampled over the brass hat, leapt over the back and got halfway up the pipes to beat on the ceiling saying, "Let me out, let me out, let me out." And they suddenly realised that the pipes were central heating. And anybody who knows Canada in midwinter, it's going full blast, and the pipes were red hot. So they were letting go, at ceiling height, letting go and dropping onto the people beneath, which all added to the fun, of course. On top of the, there was a commodore, a foreign captain, and a commander, and they were at the bottom of this heap. It was great fun. Anyway, that's how we amused ourselves. In addition, in the hallway, they had a display, a big fan on the wall, a fan consisting of pipes, which were, I suppose, 10 feet long and with heads on them with axes and spikes and God knows what. And we helped ourselves to the display and had a dummy parade with our flight commander issuing orders for sloping pipes and so on. And then we marched off with the pipes at the slope and went out into the Barrington Street, which was the main street of Halifax, and we marched down there in full dress order, and came to some imaginary steps where the leader took each step and bent his knee a little at each step so that he went down lower and lower, shuffled along on his hunches, and then started climbing up one little bit at a time, and then the man behind him would be one step out of phase, so that we marched down an incline and up the others with these pipes on our shoulders. Of course we were drunk as coots, but it was an unwinding, and we got a communication next morning from the Admiral's secretary saying that if the pipes were reinstated within a very short time, 3 hours or something, no charges would follow. So they got back there double quick, and that was it. After all these hijinks and so on, shopping in Halifax was great fun. It was lovely to see the stores the equivalent of Alders and Marks and Spencers and so on, with all the things that people have been going without, aluminium kettles and frying pans, and so we had a lot of shopping to do, but we had very little time to do it. It was over all too quickly, and we were told that convoy's sailing tomorrow, you join them before they get 50 miles out.
What was the kind of turnaround time that you had while you...
It varied enormously. Sometimes it would be 3 days, which would give the grain ships and oil tankers time to load, to load and trim. Trimming took quite a bit of time. That was the shortest. The longest I remember was a fortnight, when they were collecting enough ships to make a convoy, and that was at the time when they were increasing the size of the convoy. Somebody in the Admiralty were taking note of the skippers of convoys who we had been at, with purely elementary mathematics, that if you double the size of a convoy, you don't double the size of the perimeter. So that if you needed to double the size of a convoy, you didn't need to double the number of escorts. So under certain circumstances, it would be worth holding back for enough ships to double the size of the convoy. It depended how frequently the ships were coming in, of course, whether to double the number of ships that you were collecting would delay it so long that you were losing the use of ships and keeping the escorts in harbour waiting for them as well, which was dead lost time. So, yes, there were things about fleet air arm being attached to merchant ships. There was a feedback to the Admiralty. It should have been more direct than that, but that's how it went, from observers and pilots who had a reasonable mathematical education, going back through the skipper, through the convoy commodore, to the senior officer of the escort, to the Admiralty. And suddenly they started to double the size of convoys, especially being able to refuel corvettes and frigates at sea. And with the greater use of escorts, because of the not doubling the perimeter, I'm sure this all made a contribution. It was elementary, but why didn't somebody at the Admiralty cotton onto it in the early days of the war? I put it down to the fact that boys used to go to the Royal Naval College at the age of 12, before they'd had a mathematical education. And the instructors there were people who'd been in the Navy all their life and probably been a 12-year-old. They didn't have experience of the outside world. They weren't university trained. They didn't have... they'd never even been to night school. I did maths, physics and chemistry at night school at the age of 16. And if you used your common sense, there were so many things you could contribute something to a convoy system.
Do you think, though, by the stage of the war that you were at, the Admiralty were at last starting to listen?
They were beginning to, but the high-ranking officers were still pre-war trained people. There were no, as far as I know, there were no carrier captains other than MAC ships, no carrier captains who had anything other than a straight-laced training. the RN people, we never had a pilot or an observer in command of an aircraft carrier. That didn't come till after the war, and I think Ray Ligo was the first one, a man off my course.
Can you give me an idea of the pattern of operations? Obviously, you know, when you rejoined the convoy in Canada, how did it pan out over the next few months of you going back and forth? How would you operate?
I'm sorry, how would we operate? We were just directed to join a convoy, and then we'd fly off when it got to the other side. It was as simple as that.
You mentioned earlier, off the tape, though, obviously, as you were patrolling during the convoys across the Atlantic, that they became almost a matter of routine. How fatiguing were they, or how difficult was it for you to keep concentration in that sort of situation?
It varied from summer to winter. During the winter, you could get into a state of almost hibernation, where the mind was freezing along with your body. The sheer boredom and tedium and strain of trying to keep a watch made your eyes water, and eventually your brain tire so much that our effectiveness must have been reduced enormously. It was not enlightened by not having any sightings, not having any sinkings. If we'd had the excitement of and the achievement, the satisfaction of getting some sinkings, it would have been far easier to accept. But it was difficult to accept that we were doing a worthwhile job.
At that time, was there a lack of understanding, obviously, of the idea that you, from, say, senior commanders, that you weren't sinking U-boats, and but you were still doing the valuable job of keeping them under?
Well, we didn't know in those days just how many U-boats were at sea. It was only after the war that figures were compiled from German records, and we learned that in the peak of the anti-U-boat war, where everybody says we won the Battle of the Atlantic, there were about 250 U-boats available. They were mainly the Type 7C, which was a reasonable size U-boat, reasonably well equipped, but not up to date. At the end of the war, 2 years later, and they were the 2 years that Mack ships were at home in the Atlantic, there were 370 gave up on VE Day, either by scuttling themselves or by being in harbour or surrendering under the white flag. There were more U-boats at the end. We hadn't been seeing them, but they weren't out there on sunbathing cruises. They were out there for a purpose, and we were thwarting that purpose. They were better equipped, they were higher powered because they had better diesel engines, they were bigger, they could carry more torpedoes, they were supplied by the Milch cows, which would give them fresh bread and fresh vegetables and enable them to stay at sea longer. They could give them fuel. But they weren't getting any results. And why weren't they getting results? It was that they were being kept underneath.
I mean, it seems to me very much that at the time it wasn't quite understood then just what a threat you were posing to them flying from a convoy.
No. I'm sure that is true, except for the Merchant Navy skippers, who always used to make a point of it at the convocations, I was going to say.
The debriefing they would have at the other end.
The briefing before the convoy and the debriefing afterwards. They always used to cheer when it was said that, yes, you'll be having a match ship with you. They, more than anybody, realised the implications of air cover. I'm not sure that the Royal Navy did, but certainly the Merchant Navy did.
And what about yourselves, you and your colleagues at that time?
We didn't know what we were achieving, which is perhaps a bad thing, perhaps a good thing, I don't know. We didn't get overconfident because we didn't know that we were getting any results. We could have become depressed by the monotony, by the extreme conditions that we faced, by the weariness that we, the non-productive effect of having patrol after patrol after patrol under inhuman conditions, without any reward, without any achievement, and without the Admiralty even recognising that somebody somewhere deserved a gong for persistence, for determination in the face of the enemy. They didn't think we were in the face of the enemy.
That was something that was understood much later on, was it, after the records came out at the end of the war?
Only in, I would say, in the late part of the century, maybe 50, 60 years after the occurrence, when the records office at Kew started churning out a lot of information that people could pick on and understand, and that was that, yes, the turning point was the day that Maxships went on the Atlantic.